This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
It's been another big week in technology. The cyber crime laws are now being used to target security researchers. And many of those researchers are getting out of the field. I think that's going to make the internet more vulnerable. We'll get into more details about that. And Zag has released a new type of protective glass for the iPhone, which is a very clever kind of cover. And it's one that I'm kind of interested in because, you know, I recently dropped my phone and broke the screen. Yeah. It cost me $100.
Mm-hmm.
Citizen scientists are taking control of a NASA probe and... And, of course, Flappy Birds is about to return to the App Store.
Is it really?
Yeah. So, but, of course, it's been a huge, huge week with the mailbag.
Massive.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Oh.
Oh, it bounced.
That was a big one. I tell you, I'm going to have to start working out at the gym with these mailbags.
I think the mailbag is enough of a workout myself.
Well, maybe that could be. But I have to work out more than once a week, though, Jim.
That's
true.
Don't
they say you have to work out three times a week?
Exactly.
Yeah. We got an email from Benoit in New Jersey. He says, I store a lot of big documents in Dropbox, and then when I share them, I just share the link. I just send out a public link and share the link with people. But now I'm worried that this may not be that secure. I mean, how secure is this link? I'd kind of like to know about it and, you know, whether what kind of files I should be putting on there. Thanks, Benoit in New Jersey. I love the show. Well, Benoit, the shared links in Dropbox and Box are really not encrypted or anything. It's basically security through obscurity. So they basically have a very complicated link that people probably couldn't guess. But they're being, but people are now being warned that their risk of inadvertently leaking their own files. Intralink, which of course is a competitor of Dropbox and Box, and trying to steal the business, they said it centers on the problem of the generated public link. When you want to share it, you generate a public link, and what it does, it basically. Dropbox, basically, links are really are a little bit vulnerable because these are public links. And so what happened is that if you use that link, people might go and use that link, and then the link itself could be stored in a cache, like in a web cache if they've used a browser, say they've used that link at a coffee shop on a public computer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that link might be in the history. So anybody could just log in and they could see that link and they could use it and they could get to the file because it's actually, you know, not truly an encrypted connection. And so also sometimes the links are shared in websites' referral data. So like if something comes into a website and it's referred from someplace else, there's referral data and it's stored. So this data is around, and somebody'd have to look for it, but it is around. And so you don't have absolute security. So you just need to be aware of it. Dropbox and Box are both working on the problem, but I would not send out these shared public links for highly, highly sensitive data because you can't not guarantee that they're going to be there. We got an email from Sean in Fairfax. I'm getting out of school and I'm looking for a job. I want to know what's the whole deal about getting a job. You know, I send out my resumes, nothing's working. What do you recommend for getting a job in technology? Well, Sean, that is actually a great question. We actually work with all the students at Stratford to help them get jobs. We got around an 80% placement rate. you know, within a few weeks after graduation. And actually, the way we do it is really quite simple. It's not that we're doing anything special, but we have our students do things that are special that actually make them more employable and make them more attractive to their potential employers. First of all, we have them work on real projects.
Right.
Real projects, like setting up an Apache web server, you know, setting up VMware and running two operating systems on it, writing a database-driven website with say, MySQL and PHP, running on an Apache web server, you know, setting up a configuring a security infrastructure on a network. So they actually have real projects they work on, setting up an Oracle database, setting up a Microsoft SQL database, any number of projects. But these are real projects that they're interested in. So when they go to the employer, configuring a server so that it's secure, going through all the processes and make sure that the server's secure. So when they go to an employer, they just don't say, well, here's my transcript. I got all these A's, because actually A's don't mean anything. You know, you don't know whether it's an easy grade or a hard grade. What they want to know in the industry is what you've actually done. We have them do actual coding of actual projects. We might, some of our classes actually make applications for an iPhone or an Android. They actually, so if they have like senior projects, they actually have to have working code. Something, you know, because if they don't actually have working code, it's just fantasy. So when they go to employer, they've got real projects to talk about, which makes the interview far more engaging. Second thing, we have them read industry rags. You know, there's a lot of industry publications out there, so they know what's going on in the industry. They can talk with some confidence as to, you know, what the trends are, where things are going. Because knowing and reading the industry rags, these are these industry magazines, it gives you a hint of where things are going and what is worth learning. And that knowledge of what's worth learning really will inform your future growth in that you'll learn the right stuff. Mm-hmm. And if you can talk about that, you're already behaving like you're part of the industry. We have our students join user groups. If you're interested in any kind of software, any kind of hardware, there are user groups around, and you just join the user group. And they really like to have students join the user groups. And what you do then when you join the user group, you actually should be working on a project. What you don't want to do is ask for a job. Because,
yes.
I mean, nobody's going to want to talk to you. So you say, you know, I'm working on this project. I'm setting up this database-driven website. And then they help you work with the project. And you demonstrate your enthusiasm for the field. And then what happens is that you have this demonstrated enthusiasm for the technology. People say, you know, I've got an opening for you that might be good for you. And then they'll start coming to you because you look so attractive. So you're not searching a job. You're demonstrating that you're part of the team, that mm-hmm. you're really already behaving like a professional. There are also a lot of conferences that you could go to. Now, they could be local conferences. They're not that expensive. Some of them are free. Many of them have student rates. You go to the conferences and you just, you know, and then at the conferences you talk about projects you're working on, and then you're basically building a network of people. That's what you're doing, but you're doing it by behaving like you're already a member of the field. And so I found that this method of getting a job is very effective. If you want to see some structure on how it's done, the book that we have all of our students read is What Color of Your Parachute by Dick Bowles. We use that. That's the Bible in our career services department, and there are a whole series of exercises you can go through to see who you are, what you like, what kind of job you would like. Because some sort of self-awareness is extremely important because you go after the right field. So if you go through the process in the What Color Is Your Parachute to have a sufficient degree of self-awareness and then work on these projects, you'll be able to develop what amounts to the elevator speech,
mm-hmm.
where somebody
mm-hmm.
says, who are you? And in 1 minute, you can say what you're good at, what you like to do, and what you've done. It's like a 1 minute summary that actually is quantitative and meaningful. And we found that these techniques are the best way to get a job.
Good.
Great, great question, Sean.
Yes.
We got an email from Alex. Dear Dr. Schertz, I've heard you talk a lot about critical thinking in the classroom over the time. And, you know, it's like a buzzword. I mean, what does that critical thinking actually mean? And why is that important? Love the show, Alex. Well, Alex, I'll tell you, critical thinking is actually a method for solving a problem. If you use this technique in say scientific research, it's called the scientific method. That's what it is. And so it's an application of the scientific method to any problem that you encounter. And this structured method of thinking gives you clarity. It lets you draw conclusions that make sense. It also tends to give you ideas, though, or that would be innovative or that would be sort of out-of-the-box thinking. So there, and this is actually the same way that Socrates was teaching. So Socrates would ask questions of his students there in the streets of Athens, and he would help. And by asking questions, the students could clarify their thinking around the eight elements of critical thinking. And I like these eight elements of critical thinking. These are the same eight elements that the Foundation for Critical Thinking uses, and that would be at criticalthinking.org. I really love that organization. So whenever you're thinking about something, you have to have a purpose for the thought. Like if you're working on a research project, our goal is to make this GPS system more reliable, for small receivers, small handheld receivers that don't have much power. That might be the broad purpose. Then you might have a question at hand. So the question at hand is, what kind of antenna should we have? So that might be you're trying to design just the antenna question within this broader purpose of thinking. Then you'd ask the question, well, what kind of data is required? So you'd say, okay, what kind of data do I need? I need, say, antenna gain data versus, you know, size, whatever kind of data you need. And then you would look at the data and you would draw some conclusions from the data. You'd say, well, based on that data, it looks like the only way we can do this is if we have a certain amount of power at the satellite, because I can't carry much power with me on the handheld device. So you have some conclusion. Then you have the implications of the conclusion. The implications might be that, you know, it's not possible because the handheld antenna would have to be too big, or the power would be too big, or whatever the conclusions are. Those are the implications of the conclusion. And then you would then ask yourself and be very clear, what are the underlying models used for this analysis? So, in this case, we're using electromagnetic theory. We're calculating antenna patterns. So there'd be some underlying model that you're using. You want to be clear on that. And then you would ask yourself, well, what are the assumptions? And it's particularly the unwritten assumptions you want to be clear of. And then finally, what is your point of view? So because you could look at a problem from multiple points of view. Like if you're debating something, let me just change the subject from this antenna design thing. If you're debating something about what's the best way to teach, you might have the point of view of the faculty. It's, you know, this is easier for me to do. Or the point of view of the student, well, this is more fun. Or the point of view of the parent, this makes my student more, you know, so that they can get a job quicker. Or so you'd have multiple points of view. And what you'd want to do is look at this particular problem from multiple points of view. And usually what happens is that if you look at a problem through the eyes of another, which would be another point of view, it tends to look different. And that's when you get ideas. And so that's the heart of innovation. So this structured thinking process, which was really started back with Socrates and then written about by Plato, is how we teach. And by simply asking questions, students figure this stuff out on their own. They do all kinds of group work. And we use, you know, the philosophy of Sugata Mitra in teaching, where he believes that faculty inspire students, but students teach themselves by going through this critical thinking process. I always like to say education, that the true value of education is what you know after you've forgotten everything that you memorized. In other words, how did the educational process change the way you think? So I believe that learning how to execute critical thinking in problem solving is probably the one skill, the one ability that will get you promotable and put you in a leadership position at an accelerated rate. That was a great, great question.
We love your emails. Yes. Doc, how would folks
send us? We love your emails. Send us emails to techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll cover them on the air. We might even answer you directly.
This is Tech Talk Radio, Saturday morning on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. Stand by. More of Tech Talk coming up right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Change your life. Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Alan Matheson Turing. Alan Matheson Turing was an English mathematician, logician, cryptanalyst, analyst, and computer scientist. Turing is considered to be the father of computer science and artificial intelligence. Alan Matheson Turing was born June 23rd, 1912, exactly 100 years ago.
To the day.
He was born in London and raised in Hastings, England. He attended St. Michael's Day School at age 6. And he attended the Shelburne School at age 13. He received a Bachelor of Science in Mathematics from King's College, Cambridge in 1934. He was always precocious in mathematics and actually solving all kinds of problems. His teachers at Shelburne were always complaining. He was always doing all these math problems. And they said, this guy needs to be a total person. Spending all your time on that technology stuff is not what we want. So they were highly critical of him. They thought he was going to slip through the bar stools, as they said. But he made it through, despite the lack of understanding there at the Shelburne School. But they recognized his brilliance in mathematics at King's College.
Mm-hmm.
He got his bachelor's degree from King's College in 1934. In 1935, at the age of 22, he was elected as a fellow to King's College on the strength of his senior dissertation, in which he proved the central limit theorem. This was a major, a major mathematical proof. Now, it turned out that somebody had proven it earlier in 1922. He didn't know that. He independently proved it. And it showed that his great ability at math and at proving math. In 1936, he published a landmark paper where he proposed a simple arithmetic-based formal language, which became known as the Turing machine. And he proved that such a machine would be capable of performing any conceivable mathematical algorithm. And this was the basis of computer science. Now, I have to have an aside.
Okay, please.
I have to explain what the Turing machine is.
Please do.
Consider a tape. It's a tape with symbols on it. A single row of symbols. The tape is infinitely long, and the tape represents an infinite amount of available memory. Now, the Turing machine involves a head which can read and write. And it also, the Turing machine has a state at any one moment. So the head is in a particular state, like state 16. And there's a lookup table which represents the program. So what happens is that the program says, and suppose you're reading zeros and ones. The program might say, if the head reads a 1, and if you are in state 17, go back, go to the left, 12 spaces and read another symbol. Or it might say, go to the right and write another symbol. So at every point on the tape, you read the letter, and then you look at the state that you're in, and you do an action. You move the tape, and then you either read or write at the next location. That's a simple Turing machine, and that is actually the fundamental process that goes in it on within a digital computer. And he showed that if you could represent any mathematical problem as an algorithm, that the Turing machine would be able to solve it. And this became a fundamental theorem of computer science. And then he developed a Turing machine that could simulate another Turing machine, and that became the universal Turing machine. So this was a major theoretical breakthrough in computer science. Okay, now we're back to his life. Sorry for that aside.
No, it needed to happen.
Yeah. Now, from September 1936 to July 1938, he spent most of his time at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. This is the same place, by the way, that Einstein spent his time in the U.S. after he did all of his work on general relativity and left Germany. And he received his Ph.D. from Princeton while he was doing that. Now, in addition to his purely mathematical work, he studied cryptology. This is where he got interested in cryptology. This is where you try to decipher crypto codes. And he built an electromechanical binary multiplier. He was trying to figure a way to build electromechanical computational devices in order to make the Turing machine concept real by having something that could really do something. In 1938, he received his Ph.D. from Princeton, and he proposed a system of logic that allowed the study of problems that could not be solved by the Turing machine. See, there are a class of problems you can't express with through algorithms, and he wanted to see whether they could be solved. So it was sort of an extension of his Turing machine research. During World War II, Turing worked for the Government Code and Cipher School at Bletchley Park. This was Britain's code-breaking center. He devised techniques for breaking German ciphers, including what he called the bomb, or maybe the Bombay. What do you think? B-O-M-B-E. Think that's Bombay or
we'll
bomb?
I think Bombay.
Think Bombay? Okay. If anybody has a better idea, why don't you check that?
I'm going to go find out.
Go
that?
Check that out. It was an electromechanical machine that could find the settings of the Enigma machine. You see, the Germans had this machine they called the Enigma machine, and when they'd want to send an encrypted code, they had these different settings on the machine, and they'd set all these settings, they'd rotate these dials, set it a certain way, and send the code. The people at the other end would know how the code, you know, what the settings were for that day, and when the code came in, they would set their wheels up in the same way, and they could de-encrypt the message. Now, the U.S. and Britain had a copy of the Enigma machine, but the problem was, how do you figure out how the dials were set? So they knew how it worked, but then they had to find a way to do how the dials were set. So he figured out an algorithm in a machine called the Bombay that would actually look at the code, the encrypted code that was being sent, and it could then predict the settings on the Enigma machine. And what he would do, he would look at the code stream that was coming out, and he would assume a certain setting, and if he got an inconsistent result where this result could not have been done because of that setting, he eliminated it. So he eliminated all the items that were not possible, so then he had just a reduced set of those possible settings that he could look at more completely. And so he had a very optimized way of searching, and they were able to break the code on the Enigma machine. And this turned out to be a major breakthrough, and one of the main reasons that they were able to win World War II, because they could see exactly what the Germans were up to and whether their efforts of deception were really working. And this, the settings that the interpretation of the Enigma machine allowed them to know where the Germans were deployed during D-Day, for instance. It was actually a critical breakthrough that was a turning point in the war. Now, this was the first of five cryptoanalytic advances that Turing made during the war. In 1945, Turing was awarded the OBE. He was an officer of the Order of the British Empire. It's a very high honor for his wartime services, but his work remained classified and secret for many years. After the war, he worked at the National Physical Laboratory. He created one of the first designs for a stored program computer called the ACE, where they actually had computer storage instead of having this infinite tape as they had in the Turing machine. Turing traveled to the United States in November of 1942 and worked for the U.S. Navy cryptoanalysis on a naval enigma and a Bombay construction in Washington. During this trip, he assisted Bell Labs with the development of secure speech devices. In 1948, Turing joined the Max Newman's Computer Laboratory in Manchester, and he assisted with the development of Manchester computers and became interested in mathematical biology. He observed in biology through the evolution of things that there were certain patterns that were replicated, and he was using pattern techniques, mathematical pattern techniques, to predict biological items relating to evolution and DNA. Turing worked from 1952 until his death on this mathematical biology, including something that they call specifically morphogenesis, which I guess you morph as you go through. It's sort of a form of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, his life ended tragically, and I think this is something, a lesson that we all have learned. Turing's homosexuality resulted in a criminal prosecution in Britain in 1952. When it was still illegal in the United Kingdom, he accepted treatment for this with female hormones as an alternative to prison. He died in 1954, just 2 years later, just before his 42nd birthday, after taking the bite of an apple injected with cyanide poisoning. Mm. It's tragic for somebody who was so gifted.
Now, there's some conjecture as to whether or not it was a murder or suicide. I mean, what is...
They listed it as a suicide, but his family said it was an accident, that he didn't know that the apple was injected with cyanide.
Interesting.
So there was some controversy there. Also, many people thought that the apple computer with one bite out of it symbolized this.
Whoa. Interesting.
And somebody, because that was sort of, you know... It's sort of the beginning of computer science.
Yeah, it is. Right, exactly.
So somebody asked Bill Gates this, and they – not Bill Gates, Steve Jobs. Sorry. Jobs. Wrong guy. They asked Steve Jobs this while he was still alive, and Steve Jobs said, no, that wasn't where it came from, but he wished that would be where it had come from because mm-hmm. it was so perfect of an idea.
It is. And it's even funnier that it's coincidental then.
That's right. On September 10th, 2009, the British Prime Minister Gordon made an official public apology on behalf of the British government for the way in which Turing was treated during the war. And I think, without a doubt, the folks in Britain, folks worldwide, regret that whole chapter in his life, yeah. And we wish that Alan Turing could have lived longer and made more contributions.
I was gonna say, what else could he have done? I mean, it's untold. What else he could have contributed?
No, everything he worked on, it was like he was moving into new areas. He would have made more discoveries in biology. Yeah. All the DNA came out. Mm-hmm. There were many, many unpublished papers that were actually seminal papers that came out. The guy was actually extremely creative, very productive, extremely productive. And I mean, it was a relatively short life for all that he accomplished.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Alan Matheson Turing, the father of computer science and of artificial intelligence, was born 100 years ago today.
And as
today.
Our producer Andrew points out, how ironic also that his middle name has math in it.
Oh yes,
isn't that something?
That's very true.
Now,
very
okay,
good.
So the question remains: bomb or Bombay? And
yes,
we now bring forth Gigi, our
okay.
frequent contributor and occasional show host. Gigi, what say you?
Bomb.
Bomb.
She says bomb.
Bomb.
Thank you, Gigi. Well, there you go.
Thank you, Gigi.
That
bomb.
Was kind of a letdown.
That was kind of a letdown. I thought for sure it'd be Bombay, but
bit anticlimactic too.
I know.
Yeah.
There
anyway.
You go.
Okay.
This is Tech Talk Radio, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2. We will be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. Change your life.
Put your talents out there on your terms. Get full credit for your ideas and hard work, and set your own pay. If you're ready to be your own CEO, Stratford University's life-changing Masters in Entrepreneurial Management program can show you how to develop and launch your business. From writing a solid business plan to financing, legal issues, staffing, even branding and marketing. Let Stratford show you the ropes and walk you over the pitfalls of running your own business. Choose from online or in-classroom courses at our convenient campus locations in Tysons Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Change your life. Take charge of your future on your own terms. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Schertz. It's this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and lowering the academic bar on Stratford University's Tech Talk. We just finished talking about Alan Turing and profiles in IT, and today's pop quiz question is simply this. Tell me how Alan Turing died. If you know the answer to that question, call me right now. If you're calling from west of London, England, it's 877-936-9333. From east of Princeton, New Jersey, it's 877-936-9333. And of course, the wild card line is 877-936-9333. The Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
Flappy Bird is returning to the App Store. Flappy Bird is set to return to the App Store with some new features that will make this seemingly overnight success an even bigger deal than it was before.
Wow.
It's really exciting. Flappy Birds is an addictive game that you'll love to hate. It's coming back August 2014. Multiplayer support will likely be the biggest change, although there are few details on how it will be implemented. If you're new to Flappy Bird, it's a free game that flapped its way to the top of the App Store and spread out through social media like wildfire before being pulled by its developer, purportedly due to the stress of the sudden success was giving him. If you remember, Dong Nguyen was making $50,000 a day in ad revenue from this particular deal, and he had a lot of parents complaining that it was ruining the lives of their children, and he was like really feeling bad about it. Now, Dong had never told his parents about it.
No kidding.
And he was pulling in $50,000 a day.
Good grief.
And his mom found out about it on the news when somebody finally figured out who the developer was. And once his name was revealed, he went into hiding. And he just was really, because he's very shy, and he was worried about it. So he decided, I can't take the pressure. I'm going to pull it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, since Flappy Bird's sudden departure from the App Store, there have been a number of clones and knockoffs that have tried to take its place. But nothing is as good as the original. So if you didn't have a chance to download it before it was pulled, the new Flappy Bird should hit the App Store just in time to take up the rest of your summer when it comes out August of 2014. I actually never played this thing. It's the bird you have to keep pushing.
Yes.
The button faster. The faster you push it, the higher the bird goes. You push it at a slower rate, it drops down, and then you have to raise and lower the bird as it flies over and under these bars. And it looks like a lot, and the bars, these little bars are red bars that look a lot like Mario.
Uh-huh.
Because Dong just loved Mario. So,
you know what?
So get ready for Flappy Bird coming out August 2014.
I won't be getting ready because I won't be playing it. This is Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, and online at techtalkonline.com, also federalnewsradio.com. Stand by. We'll be right back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University. Changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Citizen scientists control an old NASA probe. The ISEE-3 reboot project has announced that it's achieved two-way communication with the ISEE-3 satellite. This satellite was originally launched by NASA in 1978 with the goal of studying solar winds that flow near the Earth. It completed its project in 1981. That would be 30 years ago.
Yeah.
But it's still operational.
The scientist was counting on his fingers, by the way, folks.
I know. It was more than 10. Now, but it's still operational. Now, after it finished its thing, it was directed to observe a couple of comets. But it's just spent the last 30 years orbiting the sun, and it's now on its way back to Earth. Now, NASA has no plans to do anything with the returning probe. But a group of citizen scientists was interested in attempting to contact and possibly control it. So earlier this month, they signed an agreement with SkyCorp Incorporated to allow ISEE-3 reboot project, give it a chance to communicate with the probe and use it for research. And the project achieved its first big success in May of 2014 using the Arecibo Radio Observatory in Puerto Rico. The project was able to establish two-way communication with the probe and access its current telemetry. I once was down at Puerto Rico. I went to see the Arecibo Radio Observatory. Mm-hmm. It was all locked up. I couldn't get in to see it, but I managed to drive up the hill, climb a tree, and I could look down, and I could actually see the dish.
And you didn't get shot. Good.
No. Okay. But see, Jim, this is when I needed my drone.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
If I'd have had the drone then, I'd have got a much better view of the dish. But it's up in the rainforest area there. That was the one thing I wanted to do when I was in Puerto Rico.
Unbelievable.
And the good news is, I was not arrested.
This is great.
That's right. So the project leader, Ken Cowling, said, "We have successfully commanded both the ISE's data multiplexers into the engineering telemetry mode. The current bit rate's 512 bits per second. We've been able to verify modulated data through ground stations in Germany, Morehead State University in Kentucky, and the SETI Allen array in California. As the team learns more about how to communicate with it and command the ISEE, their eventual goal is to actually change its current trajectory into one that will enable more frequent communication with the probe. Its instruments are still functioning, which means that if the project is successful, there may be a wealth of scientific information that it can uncover. The project was crowdfunded. It's amazing. You go to, I'll have a link to the crowdfunding. It was the rockethub.com crowdfunding site, and 2,400 people contributed over $150,000 toward this effort.
Wow.
And they're going to last on that website. I'll give a link to the website, some of their future plans regarding the probe. This is actually kind of an innovative idea to take an old satellite that was not being used by NASA and to use it for something else.
I am assuming that this is a highly supervised exercise to have civilians in control of a satellite, right?
It is highly supervised for two reasons. They don't want to hit another satellite.
Yes.
They're also worried that if they turn the power up of the communication system too high, it may interfere with some of the other sensors in the area.
Mm-hmm.
So it is highly supervised, so they don't damage any of the other space assets.
And they're sure these guys aren't up to... See, my mind is always thinking conspiracy theory, black helicopters and black Suburbans. They're not afraid that these guys are up to no good with it?
I'm thinking that it's highly supervised.
I'm
going to look more into that.
Okay.
Because I do think there is a certain vulnerability. If they have people that don't know what they're doing, they could create havoc.
Yes, they could.
But I love the idea that we can take assets like this, and without using taxpayer money, get something additional, some additional good out
mm-hmm,
of it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a highly innovative NASA initiative, and so I applaud them for it. And
good.
I'm certain that they'll have to get certain controls in place.
Sure.
Zag has announced a glass shield. See, here's, you know, I just really hate covers on the iPhone
because yeah, me too.
I think the iPhone just feels, you know, just by itself, it just feels really nice.
It feels nice. It looks nice. I mean, it is actually kind of a piece of art, isn't it?
It looks beautiful, and then to put some clunky cover on it really
makes it
doesn't
look cheap.
It doesn't. I just don't like that. And so Zag has come up with a technique. They've come up with tempered glass. It's a thin piece of tempered glass, just a millimeter thick, and it basically just covers the front cover.
Mm-hmm.
And the glass protector is very simple to install. It takes just a few minutes. You just basically clean your iPhone display with this damp cloth. You dry it with a microfiber cloth. And then you place the glass protector on top of the, you know, on the screen side of your phone. And then once attached, you simply rub it from the center to remove any trapped air.
Okay.
The end result is you can't even tell there's a screen protector at all. It's 0.4 millimeters thick. And it's hard to realize that it's even there. The glass is silky smooth and has rounded edges. You can't even tell that you've got a cover on it. And the nice thing is that Zag believes that this will keep your screen from breaking if you drop it. I mean, I dropped my phone and the screen broke. So the glass would break rather than the screen underneath it. Zag
right.
has a lifetime guarantee for the glass protector. And I think this is a great idea.
Yeah.
It also, by the way, has some kind of grease resistance, so you simply it doesn't really get fingerprints on it, all smudgy like the glass, which is on the basic iPhone. Now the only downside is the cost. The Zag Invisible Glass Shield Screen Protect for the iPhone 5S costs $34.99.
Mm-hmm.
It's retail, so maybe you could get it for a little bit cheaper. But I'm actually thinking of giving it a try. I've got a very lightweight cover on my iPhone now, but the screen's not covered. It just has lips on the side, so if it dropped face down, it would hit the lips on the side rather than
the glass.
Hit the glass, but I think this may be a better way to protect myself.
That's not a bad
idea.
I'm
going to take a look at that.
As you're involved in product testing, I say this could be a write-off for you.
Yeah, I'll check with my tax attorney
now,
on that to see.
I would suspect that Apple's not going to get involved in probably trying to integrate this technology into the screen because part of the deal here is fixing. You know, they get money when you send it back to get it fixed, right?
Yeah, they do. But Microsoft is looking at going to Sapphire on the screen, which is much more expensive, and so there is talk of going
Android,
to Sapphire
right?
screens. No, they you know, not Microsoft.
Apple.
I mean Apple.
Oh,
Apple has purchased a Sapphire production facility in the U.S. So people are saying, you know, so that they, you know, they make these big blocks of sapphire. They've purchased this, so they're thinking that they're going to go to sapphire for the. So that's actually a much stronger material, and they're thinking they're going to go to sapphire lenses. It's scratch resistant. It doesn't show fingerprints as much. Now on the iPhone 5S. The fingerprint sensor is sapphire. So the little knob, the little button down there that detects the fingerprints, that's a sapphire piece of glass, which is cheap. But now the rumor is that they're going to go to a sapphire screen.
How much do you think that will jack up the price of an iPhone?
I think they'll keep the same price
point. Oh, really?
Because, you know, now the prices are going down.
I think
the reason they bought a whole sapphire production facility is so that they could do it without jacking up the price, because they basically control production from A to Z.
Well, and, you know, I guess they're really feeling some pressure from the Android phones, too. So you really can't jack up the price of an iPhone more.
You can't jack up. So they have to try to keep innovating to try to get it. But until the sapphire screen comes out, this Zag glass shield looks like a pretty good option. By the way, it is tempered glass, what this is made from, not sapphire. As mobile grows, the web dies. Now, the web is rapidly losing users as it fails to adapt to the disruption from mobile applications. Now, the web had a great 25-year run, but the end is in sight. The protocol, which we know and love, HTTP and hyperlinked documents, which were used to build HTTP, would allow the users to easily produce and consume content to surf the web. And it was a standardized protocol. It was actually a markup language that made the web platform agnostic. It could be used on any device, and it was, you know, really very effective. But it began back in the early 90s, and it transformed the world for 15 years and became a key way for information and content to be distributed across the globe. And then smart devices showed up at the end of the last decade, and it became increasingly clear that the web had found its competitor. It's easier to create an application using Xcode or Eclipse than it is to develop a comparable app on the web. With libraries offered by iOS, which is the Apple operating system, or Android, software engineers have extensive standardized resources to build great experience for users. And both platforms have reached sufficient maturity, and documentation is plentiful, and APIs are fairly consistent. So the web has tried to compete with the mobile web concept, but it's been a little too late. The web's come out with HTML5 on mobile. In fact, the Stratford website uses HTML5 so that our website can be displayed on mobile or on computers. So it is a good way to display content on mobile because it's adaptive. But it's still, and Mozilla's moving their Firefox, to provide technology for mobile. But still, it's a little too late. Because, for instance, it used to be in the old days when I did research for tech, like I would search a number of websites and I would, you know, gather data. Now I just have Flipboard, which is an application on my iPhone, and I gave it all the keywords and all the stuff that I used to search for. It searches the web in the background and creates a magazine for me of all my Tech Talk topics.
That's
so
really cool.
So I actually don't surf the web anymore. I just look at my Tech Talk magazine.
Your app searches it for you.
My app searches it for me. And so that is sort of, I mean, so when I'm doing this transition, you can see that many other people aren't. So pretty soon, people will be operating in the ecosystem of an app. Like I don't search websites anymore. If I want to buy buy things, I go to Amazon. So I search the Amazon app. So everything is app-centric, and that's not a problem at all for apps, but it does mark the end of the web as we know it.
Shall we talk to David for a minute?
Yeah, I think we should just do that.
We need to play the music first.
Yes. Don't step.
Oh, yeah.
Walk in.
Hi, folks. This is David Burke.
Don't step. Make it
There we go. And David is getting down over there.
Yeah.
Because he's a hip kind of guy.
Oh, yeah.
Good to see you. You've been shopping for clothes.
Oh, yeah. I'm dressed up this morning.
Yeah, exactly. You certainly are, sir. Always keeping in the trends. Yeah. It's fall and he's wearing shorts.
It's Hilfiger. What do you want?
Listen,
I'm wearing shorts.
It's not very hard to be trendy in a radio station.
Yeah, you're right about that.
It's a radio. This is no, it's not radio. It's a classroom of the airways.
Yeah, classroom
That's
of the
right.
airways,
That's
yes.
Right. I took the, what is it, the invisible stairway
yes.
up to the
you
galaxy?
You took the space elevator.
The space
the
elevator.
Down, it came That's down right. on the space elevator.
Yes.
Yeah, having a slow show, bring out the space elevator.
There you go.
You know, it's always there because it'll never be developed. It's always in development.
Okay, let me cut to the quick here because
okay,
I know
good.
You guys got a lot of stuff to get to.
We have tons.
And I'm double.
And you're double parked too.
I'm double parked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The iPhone. What is the difference between now the new iPhone 5C? What is this 5? What?
The 5C and the 5S.
The 5C okay. stands for cheap, right?
So yeah, the cheap. Thank you.
That's what
I get the tip in on that?
It's cheap. So if
but
you can't afford an iPhone, that's what you're going to get. The 5C.
But you do not get the 64-bit operating system, and you get a plastic case.
Right, a plastic case.
Oh. Oh, that's not
but
good.
But people said the plastic case feels almost like enamel. I mean, they said it really feels good.
Enamel.
Said,
okay.
Like
your teeth like or a bathtub.
It doesn't feel like a cheap plastic. It got pretty good reviews.
That's good.
You
that's
like that?
Good. That's
right.
But
Thank
so
you.
The idea is that they've actually forked the iPhone product line, and so people are thinking that the 5C is probably going to drop in price to maybe $250 or $300 for China and for these other countries.
For China?
Because
how about us?
Well, they want us to buy the 5S, the expensive one.
Of course.
They're doing the cheap one for the developing...
For the Chinese kids.
For the Chinese kids and also in India.
One other quick question. I asked you this off the air a while back, but somebody may be in the same spot I am. I went to the 5,
mm-hmm.
but I have all these photos on my phone that I don't have on the hard drive. And I can just...
That's right.
Tell the folks what you told me to do, because I did exactly what you said not to do.
So what you want to do is, because you've already synced...
Oh, he's getting serious. He's putting his watch
on.
So here's the thing. So what you've done, you've already synced up your new phone to your iTunes account.
You are correct.
And it only allows you to sync up with one device. So right. if you plug your old phone back into the computer, mm-hmm. don't really sync it to iTunes. Close iTunes.
Close iTunes.
And then go to my computer, and then go to an external hard drive. It'll look like an extra external hard drive because
right.
you've got this little memory chip in there.
And click that.
Click on that and right. open it, and right. there will be a subdirectory with all your pictures, and just copy them right over. I'm thinking of getting the 5C.
Oh, really?
The expensive one.
So you can go overseas
and
use
5S.
It. So you can use it overseas.
Oh, yeah, the 5S. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's 5 shirts. That's
what it is.
That's right.
Wow, there's a reach.
I'm getting that.
There's a reach.
Some people think
they were thinking that over and
some people
yeah.
think
yeah.
it's really for
what
5.
What should we call
S stands for Steve. Some people think it stands for Steve.
Yeah.
It's probably
okay.
a better.
What does the C stand for, do you know?
Yeah, cheap.
It's probably...
No, really, you hit it right on the head, cheap.
No, it says for China, because that's where it's made.
Oh, is that what the deal
is? That's where it's made. Well, they're all made in China.
Yeah, they are.
So finally, China got their own name.
Wait for the Pakistani version.
That's right.
5P.
So the thing is, the 5C has a bigger battery, so you got a 10-hour battery life, which is what I want, because you know, battery life is kind of an issue.
It is a big issue.
Then it's also got a 64-bit processor, so it's extremely high-speed processor.
Nice.
So it's got all kinds of special features built into the camera. Like what it does, if you put it on a multi-shot mode, you know sometimes you move your camera a little
right.
bit?
Sure.
It will take three or four pictures and pick the best one and just save it.
Wow.
And
That's
then what
cool.
it does, and then suppose that, so the picks the one you'd moved it the least, but suppose in one of the pictures, that the one you saved, the person was moving their head, so their
right.
face is a little bit out of focus because
sure.
they moved it. If their face is in focus in one of the other four, it will paste it in.
Hey, take that, Annie Leibovitz.
And it will automatically...
Who needs an SLR?
So,
with a big lens?
So it will automatically do this stuff. It also... Have you ever noticed when you take a picture, sometimes it's like a bright background and you
right.
have trouble getting this,
yeah.
getting the full dynamic range?
Right.
Now it actually will adjust and do processing to give you... To spread the dynamic range of your pictures.
Look at his face.
And
it's like a 12-year-old at Christmas.
And they do all that because of the 64-bit processor.
Very nicely done.
And then finally what it has, it's
more.
Got a thumbprint. So
what's the thumbprint all about?
You just put your finger on the thing and it will unlock it. You don't
need. Can't we download that to put on our old phone?
No, because there's no there's no thumbprint the sensor. There's no sensor.
Oh,
so
okay.
there are issues with.
So if somebody steals your phone, it's worthless.
It's worthless
right.
to them.
Your thumb doesn't match unless they cut your thumb off and put it in a Ziploc bag.
That doesn't work.
Good thinking, David.
Actually,
way to give people ideas.
Actually, it turned out that Apple
a lot
did
of spy
it.
Books.
No.
Give me your phone and your thumb.
Here's the deal: if somebody cuts off your thumb, yeah. it doesn't work. They actually can detect that.
They can detect a dead thumb.
That was actually one of the things.
You're kidding me.
That was actually one of the things.
You rejected. You
what
got
they,
a decomposed
the mafia
thumb.
When they built this
wow,
phone?
Wow, man. That's
but here sound. Is. Here is the problem.
Here we go.
So room temperature.
Here's the problem. Here is the problem. I was going to cover this a little bit later in the show. There's a new item called sleep hacking. See, so now.
Here we go.
So okay. Here's the deal. So now you've got your phone all locked up.
Yeah, right.
Maybe you don't want your significant other to know all the stuff on your phone. Yeah. And while you're asleep, you're. Significant other can put your thumb on your thumb drive on your thumb and open up your phone.
This shows trust.
So this is a new term called sleep hacking.
I hope Mrs. Bobbitt's not listening.
This is a sleep hack.
So, thumb, David. Thumb.
So now,
oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Or else you're at a fraternity party and you pass
wow.
out. So your buddy, take your phone and they
sending text off your
and,
phone.
And they make posts to your Facebook account. So,
wow.
So it can't detect whether you're unconscious or sleeping.
It can only
detect if you're not alive.
If you don't have thumbs, could you use your big toe?
Wow.
You could use anything.
You see how highbrow?
Here we go.
You see how highbrow this show has gotten?
And we have gone right into the gutter.
Whatever you save,
you're kidding me.
No, it doesn't have to be a finger. It's just that fingers have the most features.
It has to be the same.
It has to be the same appendage. Item. Whatever you do.
Oh boy.
The look on David Byrne's face.
No, I'm not going there.
I'm not going there. I'm not going there either.
No, we're not going there. Jim, are we going there?
No, we're not going there. So the thing is, it's however you set it up when you initially save
whatever
it.
Whatever
so,
appendage you use, that's so, what you're going to have to
That's right.
Use.
So now, remember your appendage.
So now this yes. is the new word, sleep hacking. Sleep hacking. I was going to cover that later
that's
in the show.
Somebody,
but it just seemed to fit in. And so this is...
That's crazy.
If somebody took my hand while I was sleeping and put it on an iPhone, I think it might wake me up.
I bet it wouldn't.
I don't think so?
Hey, remember the old, were you in the service? We used to
no.
take guys' hands, put it in a bucket of water, and they'd, kind of like,
that's
you
a
know,
good
all
point.
Over themselves.
Yeah.
I think this sleep hacking could be a good topic for the bird minute
okay.
that you have occasionally.
Yeah, the bird minute.
Wow. Sleep hacking.
Bird
sleep hacking.
Sleep hacking. You need to come upstairs. I need to talk to you.
Yeah, okay.
Sleep hacking.
Yeah.
That's good. We'll stay away
We've
from the
learned
appendage
something.
Thing.
Yeah.
So basically,
we're going to stay away from that
the 5C with its porcelain veneer is basically the same guts as the 5, right?
It's the China version. 5C.
Well, it doesn't have the fast processor. It doesn't have the 64-bit processor.
No. That's why you can get
so
it for
what it is? So
it's
they,
not 30 bucks. It's still $500, isn't it?
Yeah, it's $100 cheaper. That's
right.
it. It's 20% cheaper.
Can I just change the whole gears because I have to
okay.
leave, but
yeah.
I have to
okay.
ask you this question cause as a normal person who listens to tech
yes.
talk. Okay.
Uh-huh.
What the heck is it with Google glasses? What is that?
That's insane.
What is this?
I don't know.
What are Google glasses? Now, Doc, can you explain that without having a whole college dissertation?
Here's the thing with Google Glass. I think there would be other implementations that work better. No, it is having contextual information at the moment. So you could be looking at you'd be walking down the street, and it
with
has
your Google glasses on.
It has face recognition, and it whispers whispers in your ear. This is David Byrne approaching, and then you could speak to it. You say I want to go someplace. And it will give you turn by turn directions. It
so
gives
it's
you
got that like that fighter pilot display
yes.
on the cockpit on his
it,
canopy. It's
it
all
does.
In your glasses.
Who needs that?
It
what
does.
Is that all about?
And you
I
can
don't need that.
And you can talk to it. I think wearable computers ultimately are going to be integrated into our lives.
I'm sure.
But I think the Google Glass is a little quirky. You're shaking your head and all
yeah,
that quirky stuff. I don't think that's the right interface.
And you
but,
really can't see through people's clothes. That kind of
no, deal. No. You can't. You can't.
Hey,
you can't.
that David has no use for.
Excuse me. I'm just asking the questions
that's
that
right.
normal people would ask, even though
right.
it sounds totally ridiculous.
Okay.
Even though I don't care.
He winks.
Thanks for listening. That's it for this week. We'll see you next week on Tech Talk Radio, heard every Saturday on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, and 107.7 FM, HD2.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.